market.
The S&P,
the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that is officially AAA rated. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me, as always, the doctor is in the house, Anirban Mahanty. How are you, Doc?
I'm very AAA rated. I almost feel like a AAA battery.
Oh, AAA battery.
Yeah, well, so do you know like a AAA battery, yeah, no, AA
yeah,
battery?
Yeah, okay. Energizer bunny kind
energized,
of?
Energized, yeah.
I love
energized,
it. Like you're up and... This is going to be a great podcast, Phil's. Doc is called early. If it sucks from here, apparently it's my fault. All right. Let's get on. AAA battery, I like it. Let's get on with it, mate. We've got a massive amount of news and a massive amount of mailbag, as always. Let's kick it off with a story that just won't go away.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/triple M.
Mate, we're going to have to talk about coronavirus. Yes, again. It is the story that won't go away. And to be fair, look, I don't love talking about it. I'm sure our listeners are probably sick of hearing about it, except that the circumstances are changing so regularly that literally the playing field is changing daily, weekly. We can't not talk about it. There's so much going on. The new news this week, again, we're doing this on Thursday morning, so goodness knows what it'll be by Friday afternoon. But as we speak, the news is that panic buying is officially back in Victoria. Woolies and Coles have put limits back on purchases. Toilet paper again in short-ish supply. God love them. And panic selling is also back. Overnight, our time, the S&P fell 2.6%. A massive new coronavirus outbreak in Texas. The numbers in South America, mate, are off the charts. It's a story that, you know, so what I wanted to talk about really was where are we generally, but also I wanted to have a quick chat about where we are as a country, as an economy, given that, you know, we're obviously a global citizen, both in terms of, you know, our approach, but also our links with the rest of the world. On the flip side, maybe, just maybe, we're taking things too much to heart here in the sense that, yeah, yes, we're doing it tough, but we're doing it better than, you know, probably 90% of the world's population, quite literally, if we do it by numbers. And certainly, you know, probably one of the better developed countries in terms of our, and again, whether it's luck or good management, the reality is our case number is just tiny. So let's just try and break it down. Big growth in case counts around the rest of the world and unfortunately in Victoria. Where are we sitting? How do you see the world, Australia, in the context of the coronavirus this week?
Okay, that's a lot of questions.
Start with the first one.
Okay, so here's what I think. I think I'll rephrase. The setting the expectation that we're going to have zero virus,
yep,
I think is the wrong expectation.
Right.
And if that expectation is set and if that's the goal, I think that's a bad idea. That's not going to happen. I just don't think it can happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's always going to be some cases, and the moment if you think of it as sequentially, I'm going to get to zero, I'm going to have no cases for some time, mm-hmm, and then I'm going to open the economy, and I'm going to hope that there are going to be no cases. Well, that is just pipe dream in my view.
Right.
Now I'm not an epidemiologist, but I think that, you know, there might be virus lurking somewhere that, you know, that would want to get out, and then, you know, it manifests, and then it's going to infect someone, and it's going to spread.
Mm.
That's what viruses do. If it was that simple, you know, we would have no viruses. So I think that's number one. Number two thing I think is that I think the moment any economy opens, I think we should expect the case numbers to go up.
Right. When you say opens, do you mean opens to travel or just simply opens as in allows things like cafes and restaurants?
Yeah, like when I say open, go from quarantine, stay at home to let's, you know, have five people in the cafe to let's have 40 people in the cafe. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
Right? And the reason you're going to have now, I call case count, I've been calling case count a bogey now for some time. So case count is a bogey in my view. Case count now is a bogey because, yes, the number of tests that are being done now versus that was being done 3 months back, there's a huge difference, not just here, but globally. The total, you know, the testing has ramped up. So we'll do more testing, you're going to find more cases.
Yep.
Yes. So that's true. So I think that's the bogey. I think what should be watched is what is the hospitalization.
Right.
How many people are landing up in hospital? How many people are sick? And I think if I had a suggestion, if I could be actually running this show, my suggestion would be that I think the messaging should not be around case counts. The messaging should be around if you're feeling sick, stay at home. Get tested.
Yeah,
do not go around. And even if you're feeling sick because you have fever, or you know, you think you have the flu but not COVID, just stay at home. I think that the messaging around the simple things that can be done should be the focus, instead of the messaging that, oh, we are going to get this to zero. And then I think that is where I think is the problem. So
right.
It doesn't surprise me that there's outbreaks. It doesn't. In fact, I would almost predict that there'll be more outbreaks 2 weeks after the school holidays.
Yeah, okay.
Because, I mean, that's what happens. I mean, yeah, right, the right. more people travel, the more there's going to be stuff that's going to be happening. People, if other people are staying at home,
makes sense.
You know, you can make a choice. You want to stay at home and not do anything. I think, as I've said before too, the whole point of the quarantines and the stay at home was to reduce the peak.
Yes.
It's not elimination.
Yeah.
It was to reduce the peak. Reduce the peak, get your systems ready, get testing there, you know, get people to have a better understanding, buy yourself time.
Yeah.
Right? And I think those things have happened. I think so. I think forgetting the basic things and then going to that strategy is not... So, yeah. So I think, you know, I'm not that concerned. What I would be concerned if I saw a huge uptake in hospitalization, mm-hmm. huge uptake in surges, especially those that, you know, are untreatable or not being treated or going into ICU. We have zero ICU cases now, right? As far as I understand.
Yeah, yeah.
There are zero ICU cases. Hospitalization is down, I think, everywhere where there's testing is happening. So I think this is sort of the natural course, and this will be the natural course until there is a vaccine. That's what I think. And then the market is going to be jittery because, you know, well, there's more cases and clusters are news, right? Nobody's going to say, oh, look, the death count is low, or the death count is not increasing at that rate, or because that's good news, right?
Yeah, right, yeah.
Nobody's going to say that, you know, we only had one death, right? And again, I'm not saying that, you know, that death is not important. What I mean is that, you know, it's not like... You have to weigh the relative impact, right? And I think, so that's what I think. I mean, you know, I think we should be focusing on those aspects.
I think that's the hardest part for me is in the messaging is that it's very hard. Look, I don't, you know, I take my brickbats happily at our politicians when they deserve it. I think the pollies generally of either party of state and federal persuasion, they got a tough job because they had to come out and pretty much do the fire and brimstone stuff early on just to make sure we all knew and to justify the really relatively draconian and largely, you know, unprecedented sort of restrictions that we had. And so now you're in a place of, as you say, going from this is all terrible, any case is bad, we've all got to do everything we can to stop this thing, through to now trying to convince people that a little bit, it's not okay, but a little bit might be the best of the bad options. We'll take a little bit of COVID. We'll take a little bit of better economy. There are, as I've said many times, COVID policy is not health policy. Health policy is not public policy. There are impact economic and even you know, health-wise, both mental and physical health of being isolated, of losing jobs. I mean, there's a much bigger policy story. It's a really nuanced story that I'm glad I'm not ScoMo. I'm glad I'm not, you know, state premier. I'm glad I don't have to try and talk exactly as you've just said that story through, which is, and it's, you know, it's kind of real politic. It's literally a case, you know, we have 300 people die on the roads every year. We could stop that tomorrow by stopping all driving, but we don't. We implicitly accept a degree of, honestly, deaths and injuries, which is, again, like it's a really difficult conversation to have out loud, but that's just the reality, right? And at some point, I don't know how you do it with a virus, but as you say, if eradication is not possible, then we are now in the case of how do we best manage its existence and without destroying the economy, with all of the much bigger, frankly, and as kind of second and third order as they are, much bigger health implications. If we have 15% unemployment for 3 years, we'll have many more people die of suicide or malnutrition or hunger or, you know, not having enough, literally, shelter. I mean, those things are really meaningful. That actually may eclipse the death count from COVID. So it is a really difficult policy conversation and policy communication, I think, for the guys in charge.
Yeah, like, I mean, I totally agree with that. Like, I mean, actually, I read a statistic from the UK, which actually blew my mind. So they said of the 45,000 deaths at the point where it was done, 30,000 were COVID-related.
Okay.
15,000 were not COVID-related, but caused because of COVID.
Oh, wow. Okay, right.
Right? So, this is the person that couldn't get to the hospital. This is the person that didn't seek treatment. This is the person that didn't do this. Man. This is the person that got, there's that real cost, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, this is very hard. And I agree. Like, it's really difficult.
It's a tough conversation,
It's a tough conversation. But, I was in the very beginning, I was saying that you should close. I was a very strong supporter of closing. And the reason, I think my viewpoint at that point was that you want to control the surge and you want to get ready.
Yeah.
Now that we have done all that very well, I think we can't... There's an economic cost, there's a human cost, and we need to balance it. And I think the messaging really needs to be that everyone, whoever is sick, stay at home, get tested, do everything that you can, isolate, and then, get your results and stuff. Don't go around. But if we can't expect to get to zero and then, we're going to open and then we're going to stay closed forever until, there's a vaccine. I think that we've almost become, the conversation now seems to be like a very sequential conversation.
Yeah.
Whereas it doesn't have to be a sequential conversation, right? I mean, it's all a relative thing, right? Is the situation in Melbourne bad? Yes. Is the situation in Melbourne bad relative to everywhere else? No, it's fantastic. The situation in Melbourne is actually fantastic if you compare it with many other places.
Almost the rest of the world would take Melbourne's problems if I could. Yeah.
So exactly. Yeah. So I think. So therefore, I think you need a bit of balance. And of course, that's all I'm going to say. And I don't have to make a decision, so I can just say stuff.
Exactly. that's the story. Right? I mean, that's where we're at. It was a fascinating. I heard during the week. Actually, was talking to I won't name drop, but I was on 2GB and I think maybe 3AW Money News last night. So Wednesday night, and before me was a guest talking about the fact that toilet paper runs are not unlike bank runs, and I thought it was an interesting kind of approach. So just kind of moving to the current situation of the psychological impacts, right? If you see that the April sales, just to change a little bit, the April sales numbers for almost every retailer were down enormously. I think total retail sales were down 18% in the country. May was back up 17%. And yeah, to some degree, that was absolutely the fact we closed the economy and then started reopening in May. The rest of it, though, seems almost more psychology than the actual physical availability of products to purchase. There's some sense that we kind of all freaked out in April and we kind of all just got back to business in May. Yes, there were changes to opening to close. All that stuff is true. But it did seem pretty kind of, like we kind of just got used to after the shock. The shock wore off, we kind of just got back to business, back to work.
Yeah, the thing is that our society is very consumer-driven, right? Mm. Oh, well, that sounds bad, actually. To a large extent, it's consumer-driven.
Right?
And that sounds very materialistic, but it is consumer-driven.
I think it's true.
And so in April, you said you can't do anything, you just stay at home, right?
Right.
So I mean, what did we do? We bought more stuff from grocery stores because, that's what we got to do.
Correct.
Right? And then, if you think about the support and the stimulus, and it's just, it's just whether it's here or anywhere else, I mean, there's stimulus money that's there that's not being spent. And people also, we're not able to spend what they are usually used to spending. So therefore, they're going to spend when they, the time comes. I mean, the thing I think needs to be realized here is the economic impact that we are having, and this is, I think, where it gets interesting. The economic impact we are having is self-created. It's not a financial problem.
Yeah, right.
In fact, there is an oversupply of money because every reserve bank or central bank has basically said, okay, I'm going to just throw whatever I've got at you, like the whole kitchen sink, or maybe double the kitchen sink at you so that, stuff stays alive, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So this is not a financial problem. It's not like the financial markets have choked. it's that we have physically stopped saying, don't go to the store, don't go to the cafe. We are not going to let any foreigners come in to have a tour, go to the Gold Coast and enjoy the water, right? We have basically said, don't do that.
Yeah.
So we have created the problem. And as we open, I would expect stuff to get back to normal because it's not like there's no financial shock in sense, right? Which is very different from a GFC type scenario where
the money evaporated.
Evaporated because of, right? However, what I would say is that if we continue along this path for too long, we will create a problem.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Right? So if we continue like this for 6 months, 8 months, a year, this is the new normal. Mm-hmm. Then I think we will be creating more problems by just doing that. So that's, I think, the balancing act that needs to be done.
That's the hard part. And it is difficult, as I said, because of the way we've as a society, we went so hard on the message early on. having to wind that back and then ask people to be nuanced about it is a tough ask. Mate, we are okay. Everything is okay. We are now officially, or still, more to the point, triple A rated according to the ratings agency's Moody's. Now, the headlines screen that and you kind of go, yeah, that's good. No one wants to be told they're terrible. Everyone wants to be told they're great. So pat ourselves on the back. And then I remembered that Moody's also were the ones who rated the collateralized debt obligations, the CDOs that went absolutely belly up during the GFC and caused the whole palaver. So I'm never quite sure whether I should really pay attention to ratings agencies. It's always nice, as I said, to get a positive result. But man, when you look at the stuff that was AAA rated during the GFC, it doesn't exactly fill you with confidence. That being said, the US is still, I think, AAA or AA plus or something. So we're better than them if we want to take a bit of a victory lap as a nation. More importantly, what does it actually mean for us? What does it mean for the economy? Is it relevant at all? What should we take from what Moody said about the Australian government's credit rating?
Well, as you said, it's, you know, we should take it with a bit of a grain of salt. I think it has meaningful impact for government lending, right? So, or not lending, but I mean government borrowing. Sorry. Yep. So when the government is issuing debt that other people are buying, I think it has an impact. Mm. Also, it has an impact for our banks, which are borrowing overseas, and there's the flow-on effect. I think the credit rating actually has the least impact, I think, for the U.S. government, because they can effectively print money, given that the dollar is sort of the trade currency of the world. Mm. But for everybody else, I think the AAA rating has some impact, I think, you know. Not a huge impact, but I think has some impact. I believe Canada lost one of the A's from its AAA, is my guess.
Yeah, isn't it? Lose an A. Just do it, bend down back at the couch, or maybe, you know, the treasurer's desk drawer somewhere. Or
yeah, so I mean, that's what I think. Well, you know, again, it's good. Good news is good news. Yeah. But probably not a huge dial mover. Mm. Some dial mover.
It's a funny one, isn't it? I mean, look, so a couple of things. I think there's some relative reality to it. There is a question of, you know, how are you rated compared to other people? That's always a useful idea just to get a sense of how ready or otherwise someone else thinks we are. Interesting, they call it the economy, the institutions, and the governance, which I thought was kind of, again, if you want to be known for something, that's not a bad trio of things to kind of have in your back pocket as things will kind of shore up the economy and keep things going. That was a positive. It does, as you mentioned, impact the cost of borrowing. So there is a real impact of losing that AAA rating in theory. Now, hard to see the US has actually suffered from its rating downgrade, but in theory, that does hurt you. And again, if you're not the world's biggest economy, but you're kind of an also ran down the other side of the world, you kind of don't need that against the black mark against your name. You want to have a rating to say, hey, things are okay, we'll be all right. Let's kind of get on with it. I think that was, for me, the important thing. It was almost the international reputation piece, not because, I mean, we all got ego, right? We all want Australia to be seen well, but again, the financial impact of that, the reality of, you know, how trusted is Australia as a country, as a government, as institutions, it's kind of important, right? It's necessary to understand exactly where things are at, how people perceive us, and how they're prepared to deal with us. It would have been a decent blow to lose that in the context of coronavirus. Not even really unreasonable, but just a blow in a relative sense, that Moody's saying, hey, these guys potentially are in trouble, when confidence is so important. We've just talked about that a couple of times. It's an important one. Mate, let's move on. Speaking of AAA ratings and raising debt, good old Qantas, mate. Now, you and I are fans of Qantas. Qantas is an advertiser of this program from time to time. That being said, we won't pull any punches, nor will we give any special treatment either way to an advertiser just because they happen to advertise. We do like Qantas as a brand. We've said that before. Before we were actually received sponsorship and advertising from Qantas.
I was going to say that you know, look, I have said that I love the brand Qantas. Yep. And if possible, I would fly Qantas wherever I can, unless they really charge me through the roof.
Exactly.
I'm a big fan of the brand. I love what they do. And this has got irrespective, you know, they became an advertiser much later. Actually, I was positively delighted we are advertising for them. But this has got, you know, whatever I'll say has got nothing to do with my brand feelings.
So do check out Qantas Business Rewards. That being said, and completely separate to that, they've got $1.9 billion worth of problems this morning. They're going to raise that much in debt, effectively straight out debt from institutional shareholders. Sorry, equity. Debt, there we go. Equity from institutional shareholders and the public, the current shareholders. $1.9 billion $1 billion. Now, this comes on the heels of the company only a couple of months ago, maybe not even that long, having raised debt against the planes. They used the planes as equity and said, look, you know, we'll raise this debt against the airplane. You can take it back if we don't pay. That seemed to get them through for a while. And here's where I'm confused, mate. 3 months ago, 2 months ago, Qantas couldn't have expected surely to be back in the air so significantly at the end of June, they wouldn't have to raise this capital. If you're doing the numbers, aren't you looking out this way and going, yeah, there's probably a capital raising in our future? Aren't you? Like, I don't blame them for raising debt against the planes. It makes perfect sense, right? If you can avoid diluting shareholders, knock yourself out. And if the lenders will let you do it against a single asset, there's zero downside to it, right? If you don't pay the money, they get the plane, everyone's happy. It's a pretty good business to be in and a very good deal done by Qantas. Did they, though, just simply delay the inevitable more than they needed to? The timing seems interesting so soon after, in relative terms, so soon after that debt raising. I don't know how they could have not seen this coming. I expected there would be a capital raising. We've certainly seen Virgin in trouble. How do you kind of see Qantas' capital raising now? Also, we should say, is it sacking 6,000 staff, I think is the number? So, you know, really significant personal cost. And again, in the context of JobKeeper actually already being provided by the government, right? So this is when you're laying people off in the JobKeeper period, that tells you a lot about maybe where Qantas is seeing itself financially, cash flow wise. Alan Joyce saying that things won't get back to normal for years is the phrase he used. What's your take on the Qantas news?
Well, I think what they're doing is probably smart. I expect a lot of the travel companies to be doing exactly what these guys are doing. And the reason for that is simple. If you can avoid issuing equity when your share price is absolutely rock bottom, then you have helped yourself a little bit.
Yeah.
All right. I mean, if I was just checking the chart. I mean, Qantas hit like $2, right? If it had to raise at $2 versus now at around $4.20, that makes a material difference.
Well, it'd be double the amount of shares, right? Exactly, for the same cash.
For the same cash. It makes a material difference. So I think, you know, some of that is just, I think all travel companies will have to raise cash. Those with poorer balance sheet situations, because they're all going to run out of cash.
Yeah,
I mean, that is the given fact.
Yeah.
And that's, again, you know, largely because of self-inflicted, you know, there's no travel happening, right? And it is right to assume that travel is not going to get back to normal for a long time, right? Then there's international travel, there's domestic travel. International travel is basically zero right now other than repatriation flights. So, I mean, what would Qantas do? I mean, this is what you do. And the travel industry is basically in what I call toasted situation. and travel chairs are, they're basically toasted for the time being. And I think, I mean, you know, it's good leadership from Alan. He's trying to do the best thing he can. That's all I can say.
Yeah. It's interesting to me. So Qantas has said basically they've got 8,000 staff now. He reckons they'll get to about 15,000, literally breaking as we're recording this, 15,000 by year end if the borders open up. So there's a meaningful chance to get some people back to work. The company's also saying, though, they don't see international travel before July next year. I think that's a pretty reasonable view, by the way. I don't know anyone who – I don't know how you could seriously have expected it much before then, quite honestly, given the circumstances. So to some degree, it's kind of not overly unexpected. I do wonder to some degree, mate, was this always going to happen today, or was there a sense that the Victorian news – kind of just, you know, the idea of open borders within Australia and maybe New Zealand, which we're kind of working towards. I think, you know, to some degree, if Victoria hadn't had an outbreak now, we maybe would have had national open borders in a couple of weeks' time, maybe, given, you know, effectively NTSA, WA, Tasmania are kind of their own little bubble right now. Queensland's joining that group. They haven't had new cases in ages. I could have imagined, sans that outbreak, you know, domestic travel in Australia effectively going back to normal in a case of a number of weeks. It feels like months now. Do you reckon that factored into Qantas' thinking in terms of the timing, or was it always going to happen now and they were just consequential – sorry, they're just concurrent situations rather than being cause and effect?
My own assumption is that, you know, domestic travel is going to be essentially at 40-50% of what it was last year.
Right.
For at least a year.
Right, okay.
A minimum.
Right.
A combination of things. I think, you know, you know, people are going to be worried about getting on the plane. There are going to be outbreaks, you know, and I think partly if the international borders remain closed, there's a psychological factor that's going to play that, you know, well, international, you know, play, we can't go internationally, and we'll hear news and that'll play in your mind. So I just expect it to be, you know, 30-40%, maybe 40% of what it's going to be. So, I mean, not just this, I would, if I had to predict, I'd say there's going to be one more capital raising. And effectively, unless our international borders open, I think all the travel stocks are going to be doing capital raising. Because, I mean, that's you know, you have a cost base and you've got to pay for it. That's what I think. You know, and again, the problem for, I think the problem is acute for an airline, because an airline that has an international airline has to have a lot of big assets that, you know, can do, you know, cross-country flights, but, you know, they're actually designed for intercontinental flights. And those are basically sitting there, and you probably have leases that you're paying on it. You still have to maintain them at least a little bit, I guess.
You could do something else,
right? You can't get rid of your, you know, you could get rid of some people, but you can't get rid of your engineers because they might be taken up by someone else. So there's a whole heap of essential costs that they have to maintain. So I don't know. I mean, I think that there's more pain. That'll be my guess, but
I think it's a good point. I'm a bit more optimistic than you are, mate. If Victoria can get its act together, I can see. I think, you know, we know that. Well, we heard that people rushed back to cheap airline tickets when they were made available. There's a group of people who will travel, I would say regardless, but maybe there are people who are simply less concerned than others in terms of, you know, figuring they might as well do it. The chance of catching a coronavirus on a flight is probably low, at least in their view. Again, Melbourne excluded, if you're flying between, I don't know, Adelaide and Perth, or Perth and Brisbane, or hopefully at some point Sydney. I think we'll probably get, I think new normal gets back to normal more quickly than we expect once people either get to, as you said before, learning to live with it, or, you know, the case counts are low enough that we can actually get on with it. I think either way, I'm a little bit more optimistic, but I agree with the concern there. I think, you know, these are the problem with capital heavy businesses, right? Like, you, if you're a retailer, you can lay off all your staff, close your doors, not pay your rent. You've kind of just got to keep the lights on. That's about it. And certainly that's what some retailers have done. Flight Centre closed a truckload of stores. They're only going to open a portion of those at some future point. Webjet, I saw during the week, I think for the first time I've saw, was offering travel deals. They've been doing lots of kind of PR, a great road trips emails, or, you know, stuff like that, trying to just keep in people's minds, keep the brand relevant. First time I'd seen, you know, travel, literally flight deals being offered for flights in September, I think it was, maybe some in July as well. So there is some sense of, I don't know, hopefully things get back to normal more quickly than we expect. We'll see whether that actually comes to pass. But certainly Qantas is not out of the woods just yet. And there is definitely, as you say, a risk of a further capital raising. But before we go on, I want to tell people about your Motley Fool investment service called Motley Fool Extreme Opportunities. You guys look for not the Qantas of the world, but some higher growth with a bit more risk companies, the businesses that you hope are going to be the big winners of tomorrow, that have really significant 3, 4, 5, even 10-bag potential, 10 bag where something goes up 10 times in value. That comes with more risk, as I said. You will probably, you guys expect, have a bigger strike, a lower strike rate, which means a few more failures than average. But if you do it well, and you are so far, the winners well and truly cover off the losers. And certainly that's been our experience with the same style of investing in the US. We can't promise anything directly correlated to that, but it's one of those things, if you do things the same way, you kind of expect similar-ish results, and we hope to do the same thing. So, Fools, if you want to join Doc and Kevin at Motley Fool Extreme Opportunities, I highly, highly recommend it. Again, no guarantees, no promises. We'll do our absolute level best. We promise that, but we can't guarantee anything. We do think, though, this style of investing has been proven elsewhere, and as Doc's already proven thus far in the service, is a relatively short life. Got a few years under your belt now, mate. Is it 3 years?
It's a little over three. Oh, it's actually, so 3 years and 25 days, because it opened June 1.
There you go.
So we're recording on June 25th.
Give Doc a three-year birthday present. Go to fool.com.au/EO podcast and join Doc and Kevin at Motley Fool Extreme Opportunities. And as I say every time, for a stupidly cheap price. So go and have a look. fool.com.au/EO podcast. Okay, mate, let's go to a bit of, I don't know if it's good news or bad news. Certainly it's growth news. After we talked about Qantas and coronavirus, Amazon, the big juggernaut, the share company. I own shares, and I assume you still own shares in the company. Doc's nodding here for those who aren't watching this on TV, because it's not on TV. Amazon is planning to open a new distribution center in Western Sydney, the size of 27 football fields. Now, it's been one of those sleeping giant kind of stories. Everyone was freaked out about Amazon when it first arrived. Everything was going to go to pot. The whole world was over. Retail was going to get swept before it. In the event, it's kind of ticked along okay. Kogan's been the big story. A couple others. We'll talk about another one in a minute. But Amazon, maybe if you're optimist or simply someone who's just watching these things carefully, if you open a 27 football field sized distribution center in Australia, you're not planning to go away quietly, are you?
No. Like Amazon is a fascinating company. I still hold shares. I haven't actually added to it in many years.
Yeah, actually.
Which sometimes actually when I rethink about it, it actually makes me wonder. Yeah, so I mean, if you're opening a big distribution center, it looks like, you know, you want to make a big push in Australia. I mean, Australia is actually an interesting country for many American corporations because we have consumption patterns that are very similar to the US, right, in many things, and you know, makes sense. We are also similar to, the UK. And therefore, you know, if Amazon thinks that they have a meaningful share in the US, you know, they may be able to get a meaningful share here. Mm. Yes, we are many times smaller than the US, but why not? I mean, for a big business like that, which needs growth, mm-hmm. It is going to be looking for growth. And so I guess that's a way of signaling that we are interested. We are going to increase our commitment to Australian customers.
It's a lot of warehouse space if you don't get the sales, isn't it?
Yeah.
Focuses the mind.
You know, they'll try to push more Prime subscriptions, I guess, you know, same day shipping and all that. I've actually used a little bit of their services a little more than I usually do during during the quarantine. And you know what I found is they don't offer as many sales on things as Kohl's or Woolies does. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, more often than not, you actually land up paying more, which did bother me. Most of the time I did it because of convenience. But, you know, now that we are going back to a shop, there is that question. So I have noticed that they're not as price competitive here. So maybe the warehouse is a way of getting price competitive, which would be interesting. From a consumer point of view, it would be very interesting.
Mm. I think so. I think I'm fascinated by the Amazon. Like, I'm an Amazon shareholder, as I said. Also a Kogan shareholder, by the way, and that, you know, I don't think it's a winner-takes-all story, but I think you underestimate Amazon at your absolute peril. One thing that's been fascinating about Amazon, mate, they seem really – they've opened here almost to have something here, it's my sense, right? They've never really pushed hard. Whether actually pricing, you know, promotions – I see much more for their Audible business, for example, here in Australia than I do for Amazon's retail business in terms of advertising. And there's a sense that if you look at most, I've tried to shop from them before. I think I bought one or two things maybe from the local shop since I opened here. A lot of it's that marketplace kind of approach that Kogan's also taking, where the stuff they're offering is either a questionable quality. It's kind of that, it's the Alibaba style kind of, you know, coming out of China in mass, lots of cheap plasticky stuff, or some cases really stupidly highly priced stuff that I have to assume the marketplace seller is just trying to jag a deal from someone who doesn't look any further. It costs nothing to list on Amazon, so why wouldn't you? I've been a bit disappointed actually as a shareholder, frankly, that they haven't made more of a concerted effort to actually be more relevant in whatever form you want to call that, whether that's price, promotions, and marketing. What, you know, they just don't seem to have really pushed hard to do it. Either they don't care, they don't know how to, they don't feel like they can, or maybe it's just a bit of a toe in the water. We'll kind of, you know, set up the infrastructure here, and then when we're ready, we'll really push hard.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's hard to know. I mean, here's the thing, right? This is a company that's operating across so many different geographies, right? If you're operating across so many different regions, maybe in priority order, Australia is further down the list.
Yes, I think that's right.
Right? Because, I mean,
we're smaller than California, right? So
yeah, like, we have 15, 20 times our e-commerce market overall is probably 20 times less than the size of the US. They've got bigger fish to fry. They've got Europe to compete. So maybe this is like, okay, you know, it's good to have, need to have a footprint. It's good to have a global presence. But it definitely looks like they're not competing that hard. but that doesn't mean that it can't compete hard, right? Maybe they're just getting slowly but steadily the logistics in place, and maybe this is going to change things. Which, as I said, you know, it's good for consumers. More price competition means we are going to get stuff for cheaper, that. And again, you know, Amazon is retail. It's just one part of Amazon, right? I mean, there's a whole big cloud business that they've got.
Yes.
So, you know, again, fingers in too many pies.
I have a feeling it was a bit of a land grab early on from Amazon, and we'll see whether this is. I mean, look, as I said, if you're going to open a distribution center that big, you have to, by definition, expect to grow sales. And it's not just going to be drop ship sales, i.e., the stuff that comes from marketplace sellers, or they don't need space for that either. They're clearly looking to try and make it big. Whether they do and how long it takes is an open question, of course. But another reason for Australian retailers to be a little bit more concerned, I have to say, if things weren't already bad enough, when you hear that the economy is in a funk, people aren't going out shopping, and by the way, Amazon's opening a whacking great big distribution center. You've got to. I feel sorry for them, mate. You got to wake up Sunday and think, oh man, what am I doing? Okay, let's move on. Speaking of online retail, I want to talk to you about retail, online retail more broadly, mate, because there's a lot of things going on in the online retail space at the moment. We've seen big, big numbers from Temple and Webster, the online furniture business. Kogan, again, I mentioned I own shares. Sales are up 100% year on year in May. And look, this is not a massive business, but not a tiny business either. Accent Group, you mentioned to me this morning, the footwear retailer, sales growth of 150% online in May. Now, Accent is better known for its physical stores, and on same store sales are up 1.6%. But online sales up 150% tells you everything you need to know about physical retail and online retail, right? The whole, when you're getting, you know, mediocre. I mean, same store sales up 1.6%. I'm going to guess that's probably inflation at least. Mm-hmm. I'm going to assume, and this is a grand assumption, so don't take this to the bank without checking it, fools. I'm going to assume that means volumes are probably down. Because I got to imagine the average sneaker probably cost more this year than it did last year. So let's assume that's mostly inflation. Again, I'm happy to be stand corrected, but even if it's not, 1.6% is effectively marking time in what otherwise should be a growth industry. But online sales of 150%, still a low number, so let's not get carried away. But if that doesn't, between that, Kogan, Temple & Webster, even Premier Investments behind JJ's, Just Jeans, Peter Alexander, Smiggle, again, they get online sales growth regularly of 40%, even pre-pandemic, mm-hmm. in an environment where they get, you know, moderate single-digit sales growth in the physical retail. I feel like I'm stating the obvious, because we all know that. On the other hand, I kind of want to state the obvious, because if you don't actually think about it enough, you maybe miss the big story. It's fine to say, yeah, I kind of get that. If that's not front and center of your investment thesis, though, at least as a consideration when it comes to retail, when it comes to anything that's impacted by technology, I feel like you're probably missing a trick.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, if you're a retailer and you don't have significant online plans, I think you're stuffed, right? It's fair to say.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, some of these numbers, I think we need to be cautious about a couple of things, right? One is, if people needed to buy something and they couldn't buy it anywhere else, well, they're buying it online.
Yeah, right.
So there's this old shift of sales, right? You know, you're probably going to, so how much of your physical retail sales have you actually shifted online is also the question that you need to address, right? Without taking away anything about the great online sales numbers that are coming through. And I mean, generally though, I am very happy when I see a retailer that is delivering online sales growth, because I mean, in this day and age today, it's not really hard for a business to have an online presence. There are lots of tools. You can set up your, you know, business on Shopify or whatever you want to, right?
Yep.
There are platforms on which you can basically take whole platforms and basically just launch your online sales, right? It's not tough. So I think not doing it is criminal, and doing it well, I think, is important. And then those numbers basically show that. So, I mean, you know, great on this company and good for their results.
Let me kind of drill into that a little bit. You talk about obviously the need for online retail and you know, it's criminal not to be doing it. I completely agree with all that. Do you have a framework to think about winners and losers over a decade in this space? You know, in one version, so the Walmart example is interesting, right? Walmart fell asleep at the well, didn't fell asleep, just chose to be asleep at the wheel. Amazon runs straight past it. Blockbuster chose not to get involved in, it wasn't even streaming, Blockbuster didn't want to do DVD by mail, so they didn't do that. So many of these stories are existing businesses that don't get with the program. On the flip side, if you do get with the program, and Walmart is finally waking up to this, doing some interesting deals at the moment to try and creep their way back into online retail and return as a meaningful force. Does the future belong to the online retailers? Does the future belong to the pure online retail? Sorry, does it belong to those that already have brands that can make the transition online? Is it a bit of both? How are you kind of thinking about the retail landscape in a, you know, increasingly e-commerce world?
Yeah, it's a great question. Like, I mean, I'm not a big retail sort of, like, I don't invest that much in that space.
Yeah.
But I have, like, I don't know, I have some high level, so I'll share some high level thinking here. So I think if you are Walmart or a Walmart equivalent, so the Walmart equivalent here might be someone like Woolies or Kohl's,
right?
If you have that scale and size and girth,
yes,
then I think you can afford some amount of laziness.
Yeah, right.
So if your balance sheet and, you know, if you basically got, you know, we talked about moat before.
We did. Actually, not before, funnily enough.
Oh, not before.
We have recorded already. Doc's giving away our secret news.
Oops.
Don't be silly. I'll go about this at the end of the podcast, but I'll talk about it now. This is our last In the Moment podcast for a couple of weeks. I'm going on holidays. So I'm going to be away from this Sunday for a couple of weeks. Don't stress. We've looked after you. We are pre-recording some content. And one of the ones we've pre-recorded is a really fascinating conversation. At least I enjoyed it. Maybe you won't. Maybe you'll tell me I'm a liar. But Doc and I had about moats, about competitive advantages. So if that's your thing, if you're interested in that as budding or current or experienced investors, maybe you have a perspective, keep an ear out for our special moats edition of Motley Fool Money coming up in a couple of weeks' time.
All right. So now that you know that, so maybe this is a forward reference, necessary. But
spoiler alert.
Yeah, spoiler alert. But businesses that have some sort of form of moat, I think they can afford to be. It's not a great idea, but they can afford to be asleep on the wheel without killing themselves.
Yeah.
Right. So Walmart could be asleep at the wheel, and then you know because of its huge distribution and you know it's just sheer size and its presence in you know so many different parts of the world and in the U.S. they can actually take the time to actually set up their online strategy. I think the same would hold here, for example, for someone like Kohl's or Woolies or even like, you know, Bunnings or West Farmers, for example, as an example.
Right.
But if you're small, you can't. Yeah. Because your balance sheets are weaker, you don't have that much cash, you probably live day to day.
You got to get it right, and you got to get it right quickly.
You got to get it right and get it right quickly. So I think that's the distinction, right? And so, I mean, there's probably like, you know, from an investing point of view lens, like, again, that's not my specialty. Like, I focus more on higher growth sort of thing. Yeah. But if you want like a re-rating type of, that's a silly word to use, but you know, you want a revaluation or, you know, you want a company that is a turnaround play, but maybe one to look at is this, okay, is a Woolies turning around or is a Kohl's turning around because they have the opportunity to turn around and therefore you can bet on that. I think it's like a possibility. And the same thing with, you know, something like Walmart, as you said. Mm. For all the others, I think like, you know, not doing online is basically suicidal.
Yeah.
It's basically suicidal for us, like the smaller end. And again, you know, how you define small and things like that. Now, I would say that if somebody has a brand, I think that is also a form of strength and it allows you a little bit more flex. Again, it depends on how much, you know, everything is a brand, right? But not everything is a Coca-Cola. Like Pepsi is a brand, Coca-Cola is a brand, but is Pepsi the same as Coca-Cola? maybe not. That's a debate
that
you can have. Yeah. But again, you know, if you have a brand strength, it offers you a little bit of a protection and ability to defer and delay. But for small ones, do not delay. And pure online, I think, has a beautiful future, right? Whether it's online furniture or online everything, I think that has a beautiful future because they're going to be stealing share from mostly, I think, from these smaller companies, businesses that are not going online quick enough, right?
And to have an online presence that is the right presence. If I compare Harvey Norman's online furniture sales with Temple & Webster's, for example. Now, Temple & Webster's a recommendation of ours as a share advisor, for full disclosure. I don't own any shares, nor does the fool. I don't think, do we? We might own one of our portfolio servers, actually. I might retract that comment.
No,
we don't?
No, I think we do.
Okay.
Probably because we might have recommended it in a portfolio service.
Yeah, there you go. The fact service, I don't know that gives you a good sense that I'm not doing this just to pump up our own tires. Temple & Webster, you know, the online shopping experience is just phenomenally better. And it's online retail is not just putting your products on a website. It sounds obvious again, right? Really important. But the companies that get that understand it, will actually are making it work, will have a huge advantage. That sheer reality of how to do online. I mean, if you look at, I actually quite like Harvey Norman. I quite like Jerry Harvey. He's a bit irascible and he's a bit quotable, but I think he's done a fantastic job. He certainly deserves all the plaudits over 40 plus years of professional success. But their website, still looks a bit 2005, right? Everything's in a box. All products are there. You can choose them. You can select them. You can search for them. It's all fine. It works. It's functional, completely functional. You compare that with Temple & Webster's website, though, the way they're selling you furniture, the online experience is incredibly different, and we shouldn't underestimate that, right? The same as a physical shop, you know, two different retail physical stores are very different things. Getting it right online is really, really important. Interesting to me too, mate, you were talking about the power of incumbency or the power of just simply, you know, strength, size, balance sheet. I remember, so I used to work at Woolies way back in the day. My first job out of uni, I worked in a Woolworths bottle shop as the assistant manager, and then I moved into the head office and worked there for a while. And I still remember the bloke who was the guy, literally the guy, doing Woolworths online shopping at that point. It was called Woolworths Home Shop. Now, this is more years ago than I like to talk about. But they were there early, right? And they weren't doing much with it, but they were there. And ShopFast was one of the big online brands at the time, went broke in a different life. I was an account manager for that. I went to a massive, they had this great big office on Circular Quay in Sydney, overlooking the quay. I kid you not, this is 99, surprisingly. Beanbags on the floors, big floor-to-ceiling windows, beautiful views, cappuccinos everywhere. Like this was just, like this was tech. This was like, it was all happening. And they were taking the lead. Woolies and Coles kind of just hung around, just enough to be relevant, have an offering, put their toes in the water. They didn't need to get big quickly. And to your point about, the point you confirmed it, the getting it right and getting it right quickly thing, ShopFast was just early. Like they were fundamentally just, like a whole lot of companies, just super early. There's nothing wrong with the offering. They just burned too much cash because they couldn't get enough people to use the service at that point. 99 internet's kind of okay-ish. People just weren't doing it yet. And so, they went broke. They just ran out of money. The dot-com crash happened. They couldn't find any more funders. They went from, like, kid you not, a flash office, massive plush office in Circular Quay. They were eventually above a Campbell's cash and carry store with two people to a desk. The last time I saw them before, they literally were shut down. And you kind of think, Woolies was there the whole time. Now, coming out the other side, yes, Amazon's going to try and do groceries. Kogan's trying to do groceries. Everyone's kind of seeing it as an opportunity. But Woolies now have 20 years of experience on this stuff. That, you know, they've accumulated that without investing too much, investing enough to make it work, using the stores, growing slowly as it made sense. The power of incumbency, if you're aware of it and nimble enough, which is an oxymoron for ASX 20 company, but nimble enough to be able to just turn the tap on when you want to and ready, being there, being able to burn some cash just to be in the game, just to make sure you're at the starting line in the final. You have to win your heat. But if you can be in the final, then you got a chance to win and put the resources at your disposal. I thought it was an interesting analogy to how the big guys can do it well when, in the flip side, Walmart just did a horrible, horrible job and were left in the dust. Should we move on?
Let's move on.
All right. I want to talk about brands again, mate, in a very different way. Now, this is a very touchy subject. And when I talked about this with you this morning, we both kind of went, oh, it's a bit icky. Should we touch it? Not because we don't have a view on it. We do. And listeners will know I particularly am not scared of sharing my views on almost anything, much to my probably my PR manager will probably suggest I don't, but I do. I don't have a PR manager, by the way, unsurprisingly, given the way I talk about this stuff. It's in the news this week that Nestlé is planning to rebrand its Redskins and Chico's confectionery because of the potential negative connotations of those names for some communities. For those who haven't followed the news, Redskin can often be a slur used about Native American people, and Chico's can be apparently, I think it's in South America, a slur for Latin American people. Now, I don't want to get into the PC, non-PC, change label, don't change label. I have a view. Doc, you probably have a view, I imagine. This is not the place or the time, and frankly, there's no point alienating our listeners for the hell of it on something that isn't right now super, super valuable. I may talk about it on Twitter over the next week if I get the urge up, but I don't want to talk about that now, mate. This is a business podcast, and so what I want to talk to you about is the implication, the reality that companies now find themselves in. We're in an era of social media, an era of, it's very easy for a storm to brew up over, I won't say nothing because these aren't nothing issues, but in a way they couldn't have done in the past. And companies need to be really, particularly global companies, really, really aware of the implications of what they're doing and how they're doing it, what they choose to do with themselves. And so I just want to get your general thoughts about kind of where we are in the world of corporate social responsibility more broadly. Now, there's a whole lot of terms around this. There's ethical investing, corporate social responsibility. There's conscious capitalism. There's a whole lot of labels, right, which basically talk about the way a company exists and is perceived by its community. I don't think this issue was there. It was here 10 years ago. It certainly wasn't here 20 years ago. But now businesses have to really be mindful of, the value of their brand, the risk to their brand, in a hyper vigilant social media world. Just give me your thoughts on that as a concept in your investing and maybe for the companies that are on the ASX or just simply around. Again, not should they, shouldn't they, let's leave that aside, as in, you know, ethically, morally. But what are the implications? How do you think about this from an investing perspective when it comes to the companies you're investing in?
Yeah, so if you're building a brand and you have a brand that you don't want to tarnish, I think companies these days have to tread very carefully, as you said, because anything can become a storm, and you know, without knowing what the history is for some branding, or some advertising that you have done, without, you know, it may offend someone in some way. So I think that's the reality. And companies, I think, are becoming more and more acutely aware of that. Mm. And in a way, I actually don't mind that. I don't mind that because if companies are aware of what their branding position is and that their branding has an impact on how people think or perceive or see, I think there can be a positive force. And whether or not there should be a positive force is a different thing. But I mean, I think this becomes very important if you think about what a company is, and this becomes important because if you think about what a company's brand really reflects, it really reflects to some extent the people who work in the company.
Right.
So, in a way, it therefore reflects what those people want to do, what those people are, you know, thinking about the business, and you know what their future goals and aspirations are, and you can use that to some extent to position your investing, although again you can't make that a sole factor. So that's really what I think about it. I think there are certain things that I think certain brands try to create an image of what they are. Right? I'm a purveyor of this thing. I want to protect that.
Right.
I think this is important. Right? Where the I basically
makes
is
sense,
the company.
Yeah.
And I think if that becomes a movement, then you can use that movement as a way to grow your business. Now, it sounds cynical that, I have a movement because I want to grow my business.
Yeah.
But the converse is also true. Because you have a movement of a certain form, you attract a certain type of talent, certain type of people, certain driven individuals, and they together form the DNA of the company. So it is a consideration that I have, but I apply that mostly to big trends and not really to social cultural issues, because social cultural issues, they're important, but most often they're distorted also by news. And they're distorted by both the positive and the negative side, right?
Yeah,
so one side of the news gets played up and the other side isn't, because it is beneficial from a clicks point of view to play one side.
Right.
But you know, like going back to this Nestle, if I was Nestle, I would do exactly the same thing. I mean, why would I court controversy? If I can avoid courting controversy, then I'm a responsible corporate citizen, and therefore I just do that. And I think from their point of view, I think that move makes sense. Why get into it?
It's funny though, you know, like I think that's exactly right, except that in this hyper partisan world these days, making the changes caught its own controversy by the people who don't think they should have changed the brand. And so we've had people like Senator Matt Canavan out today saying, again, Thursday morning, saying they shouldn't have changed it. If they don't like it, they should get someone else make the brand. And, you know, there's very much a sense that you can't take – maybe that is the point. You can't not take a stand. So you might as well take one and just wear the fact that you're gonna hit either way. You leave it, you get hit. You change it, you get hit. You just kind of weigh up which way the wind's blowing, which way you want to stand. Maybe purely from ethical perspective, maybe as you say, for the combination of ethics and business reality of, hey, you know, who do I want to attract, both in terms of employees and customers, and how do I want that to work? I think for me, I think it's a challenging one, right? I think it's really important to understand, purely, again, taking out the ethics and the morals of it, purely financially, important to understand how important these things are, right? Philip Morris, or Altria, the cigarette company, was the most successful company in the US in, I think, the 20th century from memory, certainly more recently as well, over the previous 50 years. I don't know up to what date. It might have been 2015, 2016, something like that. It was the most successful company in the US, right, financially. You can't argue in any way, shape, or form they did anything to change the way they did business in a positive way. They didn't start going into healthcare. They didn't stop making cigarettes. Now they did other things as well. And I don't want to get in an argument about Altria, not with you necessarily, with anyone who wants to defend them. But you know, to some degree, they made money exactly the opposite way, right? They didn't care who they annoyed. They didn't care how they were seen. They didn't care. They just simply made cigarettes for people who wanted to smoke cigarettes and or were addicted to them, to be fair. Mm. But they simply chose not to, you know, do anything about it. They simply, this is who we are. This is what we do. We'll keep doing it, make a lot of money doing it. So there are ways to make money in both cases. I think I would just say, for what it's worth as an investor, it's kind of trying to work out, where is the market? Who are the people who are buying? Who are the people who are joining the company, as Doc says? Are you getting the right people as customers and employees to make money and make more money in the future than you are now? And for some people, the answer is no. Nestle chose, for all of their reasons, not to, and to change things. Philip Morris kept making cigarettes because, hey, it was profitable and why not? And again, we can have a moral and ethical perspective on that, but purely financially, that seems almost arguable that it was the right decision for them and helped them make a lot of money for their shareholders. So I got to say, I think, you know, I have my views on certain issues and I'm happy to see some change on some issues from time to time without wanting to delve into the issues themselves, just because I think that makes some sense, right? It's always nice to see a company that aligns with your own values, right? That's always good. But again, that's kind of what they're doing and why they're doing it. I just would caution people, a bit like I've talked about ethical investing in the past, you know, just because it aligns with your preference as a person doesn't make it a good or a bad investment, nor does it happen the same in the opposite direction either. Mate, I reckon that wraps us up, but how about we come back on Sunday?
Oh, we always come back on Sunday. That's not new.
Okay, fair enough. You're ruining my surprise, mate.
Oh, okay. Fine. But it's not a surprise anymore.
We will be back on Sunday, Fools, with a special, because we do it, not special because it's unusual, mailbag edition. So come back for that. Before we go, don't forget you can and you should, I think, subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes, your favorite Android podcast app, or of course, as our listeners know by now, Doc, we're on podcast one, which is pretty exciting. Now, how many stars should they give us?
Six? Yeah.
Can you do that?
I don't know. Maybe. Give it a try.
Only if it's out of six, though, not if it's out of 10.
Yeah. Well, 6 out of 5.
There we go. Give us a 6-star rating if you would, Fools. If you can't, at least 5. Come on. That's a 20% discount. 7%. Of course. And please leave us a review. Do tell your friends who couldn't use a bit of foolishness in their lives. Hopefully a bit of education, have a bit of fun along the way. And of course, speaking of foolishness, you can get some to your inbox by joining us at fool.com.au/MMM.
Triple M.
That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back on Sunday with another dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.